And so I'm just going to go ahead and open the public hearing on Bill 2052. And if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2052 comes to us from Department of Housing. And what it attempts to do is basically raise the ceiling limit of the revenue bond authority that the department has. At this point, it is at $2 billion. It is expected that by towards the end of the 2005-07 biennium, that the ceiling of the $2 billion would be reached, slightly above that. And the bill attempts to raise that to about $2.5 billion. And those are revenue bonds or revenue debt limit, which means they're not the general obligation bonds. In other words, they would be payments or repayments from them comes from the repayments and the loans that are for the housing, low-income housing that the programs in these bonds allow for these programs. They basically try to allow for two programs, one for home ownership, single-family homes, and the other one is for multi-family rental units. Through the 2000 until 2005, or this year, there's about $700 million worth of loans for the single families, and about 7,300 households have taken advantage of this program, which allows them to purchase homes at lower than market rate because of the bonds have the structure of being tax exempt, which allows them to have the spread and lend at lower rate. The renters program get about 4,500 units. 90% of those are used by citizens with 60% and lower of median income. And the basically the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means after that, so they will be looking at the fiscal impact as that happens. However, when you look at the revenue impact statement that I've included with your SMS, with the staff measure summary, this looks at about $1.5 million in 2005-07. That's the amount which we're thinking will be above the $2 billion at that time. But the bulk of it comes in 2007-09 after certain adjustments of short-term and long-term bonds, net revenue coming to other funds, which is the housing fund, is about $344 million. And $10 million of those will come as the investment income through money in.
Okay, thank you. See, the first person who wants to give testimony is Larry Groth. If you could come forward, please, and identify yourself with me. And Jack Kinney, if you would come up as well. I'm sorry. Mr. Groth can start and then.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Larry Groth. I'm with the Oregon State Treasury. I'm Assistant Director for the Debt Management Division. First, I'd like to ask if everybody got a copy of a handout. It might be a little easier to follow along if you have this. Okay. What I'm here to do is, we've been asked to do is provide a little bit of context, state of Oregon and housing's debt as it pertains to the whole state's debt situation. a full presentation on the State of Oregon debt and the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission will be given this Thursday in the same time, same place here, and it's about an hour presentation, so I've boiled that down to just a couple of minutes today. Take a look at the first page. We have four basic types of long-term debt in the state of Oregon. Top, we have general obligation bonds that require voter approval and a constitutional amendment. Pledges the full faith and credit of the state, and it can either be general fund supported or non-general fund supported. The next category or type of debt is what we call direct revenue bonds, which is what housing deals in. And they're generally created by the legislature through statute. They're not secured by the state's pledge to pay, and they're fully self-supporting through program revenues. The next type of debt is appropriation credits. COPs is an example. Appropriation bond that we used to help with the deficit a couple of years ago is another type of appropriation credit. They're generally payable by agencies from general fund sources. But they're not secured by the full faith and credit of the state. The fourth type of bond is conduit revenue bonds, and they're simply a pass-through bond. The state has no responsibility to pay those. And they're really not described much beyond this front page, just to give you an idea of what we do have up here. Turn to the next page and show you a history of the state of Oregon's long-term debt. This includes the general obligation types, the direct revenue bonds, and the appropriation credits. As you can see, back in the 85s, 86, we had about $6.5 billion worth of outstanding general obligation debt. That was the VETS housing program. Subsequent to then, that's been being paid down to where today our long-term general obligation debt is about $2 billion. On top of that, of course, we have the $2 billion of pension bonds that were issued to fund a portion of the unfunded actuarial liability. You can see the red area. That's about $3.3 billion of direct revenue bonds. And in the next page, we'll get into a little bit more detail. Again, that's where housing fits in this category. And then up at the top, you can see about $1.3 billion in the green there of appropriation and COP bond. If you just where that green starts, and over about 1990-91, that's where we started the COP program, where we started funding Measure 11 requirements for jails, and that's what we used to fund those by large. On the next page, you can see a history of the direct revenue bond debt for the state of Oregon. The very bottom is the housing bonds in the purple or colorblind here, but and you can see where they were pretty level, just under $500 million for several years, and then about 1997 that really started to ramp up to where they're now about $1.6 billion outstanding. That's actually expected to decrease by the end of this biennium through redemptions and amortization. Above that, you can see the red in lottery bonds with $600 million outstanding, and it's increasing. And then the yellow up above that is our ODOT, our Highway User Tax Revenue Bonds. And as you can see, it hasn't had much outstanding, but it's really starting to ramp up. And as many of you may or may not know, there's about a $2 billion authorization out there to improve the state's bridges and highways. And then finally, several other programs like the Oregon Economic Development Department bonds on the top of that. Can you go to the next page? The previous slides really illustrate that Oregon's gross long-term debt outstanding has increased to just over $8.7 billion as of December of this last year. This is an increase of about $3.4 billion from the end of the 2002 fiscal year. Oregon's housing, single and multifamily housing direct revenue bond programs have increased to nearly $1.5 billion outstanding, with about $1 billion coming just since 1996. The state's debt has increased significantly in the last few years, and this trend is expected to continue during the current next biennium. Well, the question is, How is this increase and future capacity for increases in debt evaluated? Let's turn to the next page. We get to debt capacity, concepts, and evaluation. Well, there's four categories of debt evaluated. Each are evaluated differently. First is general fund-supported debt. This SDPAC, which is the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, has a recommended target limit of 5% of general fund revenues. We've calculated, in addition to all the debt that we do have outstanding, that we have approximately $1 billion of that type of capacity still available and still will stay within that 5% limit. And again, this will be gone over in much more detail on Thursday. The next category of debt is a lottery-backed debt. It's evaluated a little bit differently. It's evaluated on a legal bond covenant of 4x coverage. And it's a little more complex, but basically the SDPAC has determined that there's about $460 million of capacity available there for the 2005 and 2007 biennium. Third category is a net tax-supported debt. And this is a means by which we can compare ourselves to other states. It's from a national bond rating perspective, an apples-to-apples sort of measurement. And the current ratings for our overall general obligation are AA3, AA-, and A+ from three agencies. The fourth category, again, is where housing fits in. It's non-tax-supported debt. There's no generic capacity limit or measurement for this type of debt. State bond programs in this category are managed based on revenue streams available. The State Debt Policy Advisory Commission has determined that capacity for non-tax-supported debt programs such as housing direct revenue bonds should be based on ongoing review of constitutional and statutory limitations, program needs, sound program management practices, and cash flows. Careful and ongoing considerations of these concerns by the State Treasury, the Governor's Office, the Legislature, Department of Administrative Services, and agency management allows the state to maintain debt issuance for these programs at a level that will preserve a sound fiscal position for the state while meeting program objectives. Turn to the next page on review and evaluation. Well, when Treasury views housing program cash flows, we must conclude and find that the program is viable and that assets are expected to exceed liabilities before any new bonds can be issued. Currently, housing single-family direct revenue bonds are rated AA2 by Moody's Investment Service. Moody's is a nationally recognized bond rating agency. The rating of the housing bond revenue program is superior to the state's GO obligation of AA3. So it's a very strong, well thought of program by the national rating agencies. Oregon Housing's outstanding debt is approximately $1.6 billion. Prior to the redemptions of the short-term debt back in January 1st of this year, their debt limit reached the $2 billion limit, and it precluded any new issuance of bonds at that time. Subsequent to then, there's been redemptions and pay downs, so their current outstanding is 1.5 under the limit. So conclusions, after a review of their cash flows and program management, the Treasury has concluded that housing's direct revenue debt is being prudently managed, and we recommend increasing housing's authorization to $2.5 billion from the $2 billion requested in House Bill 2052.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Any questions for this? Seeing none, Mr. Kinney, if you would proceed with your.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is Jack Kinney. I'm the Deputy Director at Oregon Housing and Community Services. And thank you, Larry and Mazen, for your introductory remarks. I'm not going to go ahead then and read my testimony. They've covered a lot of the key points, one of which being that this is not an obligation debt. This is a revenue program, and it's backed only by the program revenue. So the state is not on the hook It is a well-managed program, as Larry has alluded to, and it's Moody's has verified. We have a very low default rate with our single-family program. And let me back up just a little bit. We have two primary programs that these revenue bonds support. One is a first-time home buyers program for people, typically serves people at 80% of area median income, helps them get into their first home. We have loans currently in 35 counties. These loans typically are insured through FHA or Federal Rural Development. If the owner is willing to put 20% down, insurance isn't required. But for the most part, these loans are very safe. And it's a good program to get people into home ownership. A lot of times, I mean, a typical story was in the Bend Bulletin recently. A 29-year-old single mother, 16-month-old child, worked at a bank. Housing prices in Bend were like $195,000 typically for what she was looking at. She was able, through our program, to get into a home basically paying about the same she had paid in rent in Bend. So that's the type of thing this program can achieve for those people who have a good credit score, a good working track record, gets them into the ownership in society, and lets them start to appreciate an investment, get some wealth going for themselves. These bonds also support multifamily, basically apartment buildings for low-income tenants, but these programs basically serve people at 60% of area median income or less. Again, we pass through the reduced interest rate that we're able to achieve by issuing tax-exempt bonds to the developers of affordable housing. In order to do that, they agree to keep the rents affordable for a period, typically a minimum of 30 years, sometimes longer. So these programs meet a great need in Oregon. Oregon, during the 90s, had the highest increase in single-family home prices of any state in the nation. We are now 42nd in the nation in home ownership rates, so I think this program is an effective tool in addressing that need. Renters, again, we are one of the highest states for cost-burdened renters as well, so this program serves an important function. It is well managed. We, as I said, the single-family program is primarily insured through FHA and RD. The multifamily program, on the risk-sharing side, that's a program that we share the risk with the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department. So if there are any losses, they're split 50-50 with the federal government. The conduit program that Larry mentioned, there is no risk to the state for that program. So those are the primary two programs that this increase would support. We are projecting that we'll hit the 2.5 debt limit late in 2005-07, but things can change, and it might actually happen earlier than that. It might happen later, but we don't want to be in a position where we have to curtail the program because circumstances have brought us up to the debt limit earlier than anticipated. I think that's pretty much what I have to say. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Chair recognizes Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jack, as I read, and I'm looking at line 8 on the face page, where there's talks to the $2.5 billion moving up from $2 billion, it appears that this was last amended according to 456.661 of the Oregon Revised Statutes in 2001. First of all, how fast is it growing? You provided us some history before 2002. When did we exceed 500 million? It looks like the program is anticipated that sometime about 2000 to 2007, the program went from somewhere in the vicinity of $1 billion to $2 billion. And then I'd like to ask some questions relative to the size of city. As I look at the particularly the $30 million limit, it says, and I'm reading from 456.661, the amount of $30 million of the total $2 billion, which we're asking for 2.5, of bonds authorized under this section, proceeds from the sale of bonds shall be made exclusively available for making or participating in making residential loans for single family homes in cities with population of 300,000 or more. What cities are those 300,000 or more in the state of Oregon?
Chair and Representative Butler, those are good questions, and let me give you a little background on that. Obviously, city of 300,000 or more, the only one that I'm aware of is Portland. But this program does serve the entire state. As I said, we have loans in 35 counties. Sometime before I came to the department, which was 10 years ago, there was a section added to the statute that allowed that $30 million would be made available exclusively for cities over 300,000. I think the important thing to recognize about this bill is we have never had to take away from the rest of the state to serve the needs of cities of over 300,000 because we keep the program running based when the debt limit needs to be increased, we increase it. If the program would be restricted arbitrarily, and we had to then make sure that cities over 300,000 were given their 30 million, it could impact the rest of the state. But that's not something that we've had to deal with historically. So even though that piece of the statute remains in place, and it's the first one you see on line 8 of the bill, as you said, the actual driving statute is on the next page, and this is just because the $2.5 billion is increased in the main part of the statute, which is 456-661, there's this reference to that that also had to be amended. So really, we have not ran this program to the detriment of the balance of the state because of Portland. Portland has, in recent years, asked to use this section to address specific needs, such as rehab housing. There'll be low-income people who want to get into a house that's really a fixer-upper. And we've made limited loans directed to Portland based on that program. But again, because we increased the debt limit, anyone in the balance of the state who needs a first-time home buyer loan, we're able to deliver.
And Mr. Chair, to be responsive, the history, when did we last double the program from $500 million to $1 billion? As I'm looking at the program, it appears that 2000 to 2007, it goes from $1 billion to $2 billion, which doubles the size of the program. How long did it take us to get from $500 million to $1 billion? Jack, do you have any recollection of that?
Well, Representative Butler, I'd be happy to, and Chair Representative Butler, I'd be happy to get back to you with the specifics on that. Larry from the Treasurer's Office is showing me a graph that indicates that it was probably sometime in 96 that we hit the $500 million level, but I'll get back to you with the specifics on that.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Mr. King?
Chair
recognizes Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another Representative Butler sold my question.
Sorry.
I'd like to go back to, I know you don't have the statistics in front of you, but the growth. I mean, can you or the Treasury Department give us an idea of the growth? We're talking about this growth is so sudden. That's pretty sudden growth. Is that probably due to low interest rates, or what's your speculation on why the program doubled very quickly?
Chair O'Reilly, Representative Boquist, I will speculate a little based on my knowledge of the program. There's a couple things. Obviously, housing prices are increasing significantly in Oregon. So when we make a For example, the next bill that we'll be looking at talks about House Bill 2054 will address this as well. But as little as 10 years ago, average house price in our program was in the neighborhood of $65,000, roughly. It's now $125,000 or something like that. So just in 10 years, you've seen each loan doubling. So that's not inconsistent with the increase in the debt limit. I mean, every loan is doubled. I don't have the figures in front of me now on multi-unit, but it's probably not that as dramatic, but it's still significant. I remember when I was at the department, and $75,000 to $80,000 a unit, you know, was probably not uncommon, and particularly in hard-to-reach populations, or particularly construction costs have increased significantly in the last few years. So I think a big piece of this has to do with housing costs in Oregon and nationally. And in addition to that, there are some other technical reasons relative to private activity bond carry forward that we've been able to receive. In a way, because the economy has not been great in recent years, there's been less activity in some of the other programs, and so we've been able to take advantage of that bonding authority.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair? Is it not correct that the failure rate or the foreclosure rate is actually smaller on these than the normal state average?
Chair Riley, Representative Boquist, that is correct. Our default rate or our past due rate is lower than the national average for our first-time home buyer program. I think ours is in late 2004, our past due rate was 3.79%, and the national average was around 5.6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Stay at the chair. I see you're in the next one. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing for House Bill 2052. And I'm going to open the public hearing for House Bill 2054. And, do you have anything on that?
Indeed, Mr. Chair, the Legislative Revenue Office would always have something for you. The House Bill 2054, in the bulk of what it does, Mr. Chair, is it tries to adjust the statutes in a way to put them in different places. If you see from sections, different sections of the bill, sections 3 and 4, and it takes the language from that part and puts it in the beginning of the bill. So a lot of it is of that nature of housekeeping. However, the most significant parts of the bill tries to change the process by which the loans and the determination of how these thresholds of loan amounts are determined. In the old or the current law as stands today, for example, you would have the single family home loan ceiling or cap is at $150,000, and this bill tries to give that responsibility of determining what is a ceiling to the department to be established by administrative rule, and that administrative rule basically would adjust that ceiling into the different years with the different movements of prices and so on. However, it also gives the exceptions for that ceiling once there are applications for houses that are higher than that ceiling to the council, the Housing Council, to review in a public hearing. With the names and the amounts and documentations to be in that public hearing. So in that sense, that does not apply to the multi-family homes. That stays in statute at $100,000 for the limit. And the final thing that the bill tries to do is extend the years by which the maturing of the bonds for the housing goes from 42 to 47 years. That extension will probably give a different structure to the bonds and allows for different types of payments. But that's what the bill does, Mr. Chair, and I don't see accordingly any revenue impact for that per se, and also fiscal office does not see a fiscal impact.
Thank you. So, Mr. King, if you would identify yourself again.
Again,
proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jack Kenney, Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Again, your staff has outlined the key points of the bill very clearly. And I guess there's no sense going over old ground on what our single-family program does, so I'll skip through that. I just wanted to say that the Housing Council, which is the oversight body for my department, consists of 7 members appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate. They are in support of this bill. They are the ones who currently approve first-time home buyer loans over $150,000. When this limit was put into effect in 95, there was probably one or two loans a month, if that, that came before the Housing Council. It was really, the bill was put in place to identify anomalies and make sure that the Housing Council was looking at loans that were kind of outside the norm. I think last month there were over 40 loans on the Housing Council's agenda. This really, I think the Housing Council's role is to set policy at a higher level to make sure that program structure is appropriate, you know, the appropriate insurances are in place, that perhaps we look at serving low-income people or we don't target the loans for one metropolitan area or another. And I don't think they're particularly believe that it's their role to look at somebody's, you know, back-end ratio or if they have, you know, how many cars they have, that type of thing. Furthermore, the current statute, because it causes a delay in the processing, our private sector banks, and I probably didn't say this in my testimony on 2052, but our program is run through private sector banks and lending institutions. They're the ones that originate the loans. And this delay in getting the approval for the loan basically means that they can't recapitalize their funds as quickly. So I know that the banks would appreciate this change. Again, the Housing Council will establish a new limit if this legislation is approved through administrative rule, and they'll be able to tailor that if they want a higher rate in a particular area, or that'll be their determination. So this allows the Housing Council some flexibility in exercising their oversight. I think that's the primary purpose of the bill. As Mazen said, it also there's a provision in the bill that allows us to issue loans for 47 years instead of 42, which is the current statute. Just briefly on that, there are times in this tight economy where a 40-year loan will actually allow the payments to get to a level where you can serve very low income. A good example of this is in McMinnville. My director, Bob Repine, worked with an organization of people who were adult parents of developmentally disabled, actually parents of adult developmentally disabled children, and they were looking to get a group home, for example, very low income, as you might suspect. And they put together a project in McMinnville. The only way they could make the thing pencil was to do a 40-year loan. Just so you know, the department builds safeguards into programs like that. We make sure that there are enough reserves for things like fixing the roofs and the siding and the sidewalks. So these projects will be maintained to community standards and to keep them decent and safe for the inhabitants. So just because the loan term is longer doesn't mean that these things are going to be falling apart in any way. Also, sometimes having the flexibility to do a 40-year loan allows us to negotiate with a developer and say, hey, can we get maybe a few more units at 50% of area median income instead of 60? So it's just another tool in our tool chest, so to speak, and it's not uncommon to see 40-year loans in the private sector for multi-unit, for apartment buildings. So let me see. I think I've already mentioned that the safeguards will remain in place with the loan program, so this should not take away from the good track record that our program has. There's some other changes to clarify things that are already in practice. For example, new financing tools have been developed since the statute was originally written, such as lease guarantees. We've always brought them to the Housing Council to approve if they were over $100,000 in the past. This bill simply codifies that relationship. And then there's some other housekeeping changes that Legislative Council thought made the current statute flow a little better. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hans?
Thank you. I want to ask you about the 47-year loans, and the legislation doesn't have any of those safeguards or the counter to the risk kind of language that you talked about, does it? Or maybe it doesn't. I don't see it.
Chair Riley, Representative Haas, the safeguards in that, let me just talk a little bit about how the program works, and I'll have to think whether or not the legislation includes it. Certainly the investors, like Moody's, who Larry Groth talked about before, they're going to be looking to see if your loans and your bonds are mismatched or not. So, and they may not approve the transaction, you know, for the high bond rating without it. So there is that control. In addition, the fact that we are stretching it to 47 years is in effect giving us an additional control, because what we want to do in a project is we'll issue the bonds, but we don't give the proceeds to the developer until the project has been built and until they've achieved stabilized occupancy. So we're not going to give them the money if we don't have the asset, and if they're not managing the property well and filling it with tenants, we're not going to give them the money then, because we're thinking that they won't be able to make their mortgage payments. So in a way, this provides a safeguard, or allows us to provide policy safeguards. The statute itself, again, I think this just enables us to prudently manage the program more so than directive, giving a directive in the statute.
If I could follow up. I just think that 47 years is a long time for a loan, and if you use your analogy about the developmentally disabled home, I mean, you could keep going. You could go to 70 years and finally make it affordable to do all kinds of good things. But I'm just wondering if maybe there needs to be tougher requirements, more down payment from that developer that you spoke of, for an example. Or, 30 years is a long time. And about 47 years, I'm just wondering where you stop this and at which point it becomes a higher risk for the state.
Chair Riley, Representative Haas, those are good points. And, this is something that we wrestle with when we make the loan as well. Getting additional down payment and assistance, getting additional money down, particularly for an organization like this, there's less and less funds to do that. The federal government is pulling back on their home program, which provides grants. There's less money in the housing trust fund than in days past. So there's fewer resources like that available. That's another reason you're stretching. We structure the loan so that there's less risk involved. We make sure, as I said, not only for the reserves to be there, but we build in a vacancy factor, for example. So the prudent underwriting takes place. The longer the term of a loan, there's greater risk involved. But again, as the loan gets paid down, the risk is minimized in that way as well. Just with like your mortgage on your home, the more you pay it down, there's less risk that you'll lose it. So it's, you're making valid points, but again, this is becoming the industry standard. It's not something that we do for every loan, but it's something that we'd like the opportunity to do when unique circumstances present themselves, such as the developmentally disabled home. And certainly those children won't live the 40-year term of the loan, but there's agreements, on the title, there are long-term agreements so that when those children pass away or move on, then we'll be able to use the facility for other people in the community with the same needs.
Thank you.
Well, since I don't see any other questions, I'm going to go ahead and... Yes, certainly.
Just want to see if the latest HUD reductions in the Section 8 program for the 5%, would that make any impact on this?
Why don't you go ahead and ask me?
The HUD program, they reduced the 5% Section 8 payments related. Is that coming into play here at the meantime?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, Mazen, that's a good question. That very well could have an impact on many aspects of affordable housing. Not all of our projects have Section 8 subsidies in them, so let me just say that right up front. The Section 8 program is the premier program, I guess, for affordable housing nationwide, and that allows people to pay what they're able to afford. Our program typically restricts rents at a certain level, so that if you made 60% or 50% of area median income, the rent would be affordable to you. If you make less than that, you're just going to be cost burdened. You're still going to pay a lower rent than market, but you're going to have to pay more out of your pocket than HUD would think would be wise. Some of the projects that we put bonds on do have Section 8 subsidies associated with them. So that could be relevant, although if that were the case, again, you've got that situation throughout the portfolio. So I don't think that's specific to this bill. I think that's going to be that could be a larger problem nationwide and statewide as well. And so I think that, if anything, that'll drive the market for our program, because there's less and less subsidized rent than this restricted rent will actually be the next best game in town. So if anything, when people fall off the Section 8 rent rolls, their next best option will be to go into the housing that we develop through this program.
Anything else? Any other questions? Representative Boquist.
One follow-up, Chris. Back to the 42 versus 47 years, what's the oldest property you have right now on loans?
Chair Riley, Representative Boquist, I'm thinking it's probably 1981 vintage. I could get back to you on that. But
25 years, roughly.
Right.
I see some nods back behind you. So
oh, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe they're nodding off.
I have that ability.
Any other questions? Well, with that, I'm going to close the public testimony on House Bill 2054. Is there any other business before we adjourn?
Thank you very much.
Well, in that case, I want the committee to recognize that when I'm at the chair, we get out early, and I'm going to adjourn the committee.
I like this.